deals with them.
Yeah. I have no idea where this is going to land. So I was asked to give something talking about basic bacteria, and I realized what I did first probably is not proper for this audience. So I changed it a bit, and I thought, because I'm looking at the list, I don't think anyone is doing this, giving kind of a general introduction to infectious disease and antibiotics in general. And I think for this type of course, that is needed. So, but we'll see where it lands. And it's going to be a mix of this and that. And please interrupt me anytime.
No worries.
You don't need that. Okay. Okay. So shut up, most of the time.
What are you going to say? Please, young people.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah. That's nice.
Yeah, and Bruce, you should stay awake at least. 5 minutes, I'm happy. Okay. So I would like to start with this. I think this is a good starting point for this meeting, actually, to look at what we are talking about here. And we are interested in drug resistance, evolution of drug resistance, and that is infectious disease. And if we look at the total kind of burden of diseases, these are global death causes from 2002, and it's not really very much different today. It's really two top positions. So it's cardiovascular diseases, which is about 20% of all deaths, and about the same for infectious diseases. And an important difference between these is that these mostly affect people above the age of 50, and these deaths are mainly below 45. So the effects of these kind of diseases on a population are quite different. So what kind of organisms are causing these problems? I thought I would show you this, just to, since you're a theoretical physicist, you like numbers, I guess. So this is just kind of listing some numbers for prokaryotes. This is archaea and eubacteria. The number of individuals on a global scale is about 10 to the 31. And most of that is marine bacteria. This is the leader. This is the most common bacteria there is. The number of species, depending on how you define a species for prokaryotes, is perhaps in the order of 10 to the 9. And if you compare this with eukaryotes, and the number of individuals, of course, is much less. The number of species is much less. But the interesting thing, if you look at the amount of carbon globally, it's about the same amount of carbon biomass in prokaryotes as it is in eukaryotes. And most of that is in plants, and some is in marine animals. And then you have viruses, which are about tenfold more than prokaryotes, and the mass of these are much less. And an interesting fact is that it's been estimated that of this prokaryote population, these viruses will turn over about 20% of these organisms in one day. So there's an enormous turnover of biomass by phage in these systems. But of course, not all of these are causing disease. So if you look at the most common one, the top six ones here, it's really less than 20 species. So that accounts for more than 80% of human mortality due to infectious disease of bacteria, viruses, and parasites. So the leader here is really respiratory tract infections. About 4 million people die each year of that. So, and it's three bacteria that's in the top plus influenza virus. AIDS in second place, HIV virus, diarrheal disease, also a mix of viruses and bacteria, tuberculosis, malaria, and measles. And something that's interesting or depressing, depending on your perspective here, is that really but most of this infectious disease is really preventable. So we have to put that in perspective when we talk about antibiotic resistance. The reason people die of infectious disease is mainly not because of antibiotic resistance. It's because of limited access to drugs and treatments. So if we look at these numbers, a very, very small fraction of these, it's really hard to estimate, but I would say probably less than 10%, it might be less than 5%, of these can be attributed to antibiotic resistant infection. Most of it's simply an access problem. That is, these deaths are in principle preventable with our current arsenal of drugs and things we could do to deal with infectious disease.
Drugs and sanitation.
Drugs and sanitation, clean water, better living conditions, and so on, vaccination, so on. Yes?
I'm still parsing on bits of prokaryotes still all over.
Yeah.
How do you know this?
I don't know it.
He estimated the vision rate of the prokaryotes.
Yeah. I mean, this is based on experiments with marine phage and bacteria and the turnover rates in those populations. And that's, of course, the majority of the biomass, both in terms of viruses and prokaryotes. But it might be an overestimate. I mean, I can't really judge those kind of claims if they are reasonable or not. But
it implies a five-day generation time.
The majority of the biomass turnover is the bacteria, but the estimate of the majority of the biomass of bacteria is not, and the majority turns over very slowly. But those estimates are uncertain about that.
Yeah. No, I mean there is a big uncertainty to that number, but
that's a curious number. I expect that most of the turnover is through protozoa and zooplankton eating them up rather than phage. Although I love phage.
I mean, the density of the protozoans is so much lower. I mean, the probability of an average bacteria in a marine environment meeting a protozoan, I think, is pretty low. I mean, of course, there are environments that will happen, but I think most of these numbers really come from marine systems because that's the majority of the bugs.
Around 10 to the 6 per mil in the ocean.
Yeah. Just to me as well. Okay. So if we look at these pathogens, where do we find them? The microbes that are pathogenic, and we look at the three domains of life, it's really in a quite limited part of the eubacterial tree. It's also at the kind of the base of the eukaryotic tree with the protozoans and so on. There are really no pathogens as we know among the archaeans. There is claims that some archaeans are involved in, or at least associated with periodontitis, but they are probably not causative. They are there because of the disease. They are not causing the disease.
So, excuse me, is this so there are no pathogens affecting any other organism or human?
I'm talking about human pathogens now. So, that's a good question. I don't know what it would look like for other types of organisms. But among the archaeans, it's probably generally because of the environment they're living. Quite a few pathogens in general, I would say. And if we look at this is kind of a messy tree, and it's an old one. This is for eubacteria. And you can see that it's really very few phyla, as they would be defined here, for protobacteria, firmicutes, and spirochetes. Those are really the three major phyla of perhaps 30 to 50 eubacterial phyla that have the major pathogens. So proteobacteria and firmicutes in particular. So all the major ones, Staphylococcus, Streptococcus, Mycoplasma, Neisseria, Haemophilus, E. coli, they are really limited to these two phyla. Okay, so that was just as a general introduction to where we find the pathogens. If we start looking a bit at, I love this slide, and I know Bruce loves it too. He always shows this. If you look at the role of antibiotics, and this is data from the US, and it probably would look similar in Europe, Western Europe, infectious disease mortality throughout the 20th century. And you can see this kind of curve. I'm sure you all know what this is. But what's striking in this slide, or this figure, is of course that most of the decrease in infectious disease actually occurred before a common effective antibiotic was introduced. So penicillin came for public use basically after the war, the Second World War, so the mid-40s, and most of the reduction here in mortality of infectious diseases had already occurred. And this, of course, is the flu pandemic. And these are what's called the golden years for antibiotic development, basically from the 50s to the 70s. The majority of the antibiotic classes that we use today, they were actually developed from the 1940s to the 1970s. Very little has happened after the 1970s in terms of new antibiotic classes. And you can see it really very much didn't happen with regard to mortality in this type of population because of the introduction of antibiotics. So what would you conclude from this? That antibiotics doesn't matter, that they are not improving our conditions, that they are not reducing mortality? No, it doesn't mean that. But what it tells us is that the most of infectious disease is actually the reduction is due to other factors than antibiotics. And that this reduction because of antibiotics, in comparison, is quite small.
What are the other factors?
Cleaner water, better nutrition, better sanitation, better living conditions in general.
And vaccination.
Vaccination is also in there. But that's probably not the main reason, because most of this reduction at this point, most of the vaccines we use today were not introduced here, they came later. So most of this is really kind of associated with kind of socio-economical factors rather than medicine as such. Yes?
And I think this might like be a bit misleading, right? Because in a vaccinated population, of course, the role of antibiotics is reduced because everybody's vaccinated. Mm-hmm. If you look in the world, right, vaccination is very patchy.
Yeah.
So even nowadays, in parts of the world which are not heavily vaccinated, the role of antibiotics is important, right?
Yeah. That's a good point. I'm not trying to say here that antibiotics are not important, because my next slide is saying exactly the opposite. So in spite of this figure,
Sorry to interrupt, but how far down that curve is our other parts of the world?
I mean, most, it depends on where you look. I mean, some parts are still in this area. So it all depends on where you look.
Presumably the age distribution of the deaths also changes to that period.
Yeah.
I don't know, why doesn't he say that it's not important? Because I would say, if you want to go to the other parts of the world, then clearly improving other factors is more important than giving the antibiotics, no?
In principle, I mean, if you would look at it from kind of an efficiency perspective, how much would you get per dollar invested in terms of reducing infectious disease? In many parts of the world that have high infection rates, it would be much better to invest that in clean water than giving people antibiotics. So you could get that reduction. But for a population like the US or Western Europe, where we kind of have had this reduction already, and the further reduction we have, that is, a large part of that is because of antibiotics. And of course, I always kind of challenge when I teach med students with this and see if they can come up with something else, except perhaps for vaccination, that, that is comparable to this, and it, there, it really isn't. And I mean, antibiotics are exceptional from many points of view. They're extremely effective. There are hardly any other class of medicines that can kind of take you from a life-threatening conditions to cure in a few days. It's very cheap. Antibiotics are really cheap in relation to the effect, and that's part of the problem when it comes to drug discovery and development of drugs. They are really too cheap. They should cost much more. They have very few side effects generally. So again, if you compare, for example, to some cancer drugs, they might give you indigestion or something, but the side effects are really moderate, I would say. And if you look at what most antibiotic is used for, more than 90% is really for in a community setting. And I'll get back to this later. So the antibiotic pressure is really in the community. We focus a lot on hospitals, but most is actually used for, I wouldn't call them trivial, but kind of respiratory tract, urinary tract type infections in the community. Again, it depends on where you look. I'm talking now mostly about developed Western countries.
Of those ones, what fraction of the people would just recover anyway, but the antibiotics
It depends on what you look at, but there are some data, for example, if you look at streptococcal disease, strep throat, for example. To give antibiotics for strep throat is really not necessary in most cases because it will spontaneously cure. It's the same for urinary tract infections. It can be a very disturbing infection, but in most cases that would spontaneously cure. It's just that it would take a while and you would have symptoms that are not nice to have. So for example, for strep throat, if you look at penicillin treatment of strep throat, the effect you get is, if you look at the curing rate, there is no big effect without giving anything and giving antibiotic. You kind of reduce the time with symptoms with perhaps 1 to 2 days. But in terms of bacteriological cure, you kind of reach the same similar frequencies without treatment. Of course, there are a few cases where you get serious other symptoms and side effects of a streptococcal infection. And you kind of have to weigh that into this equation as well. But perhaps the most important thing is this, and we kind of tend to forget that because we think about this kind of community-acquired infection, but really the effect for us living in a developed country with kind of developed medicine is really this, that we are at risk of losing this. So basically, most therapies, cancer chemotherapy, deep surgery, transplantation, device surgery, neonatal care, and so on, are dependent on antibiotic. So the risk, for example, of getting infection, if you get a treatment with chemotherapy, if you wouldn't have antibiotics, you would most likely die of an infection before you would die of your cancer. The same for deep surgery transplantations. The risk of getting an infection if you do deep surgery is very, very high if you cannot use antibiotics in a preventive way. So these are the things, I think, that for us are most important. They're going to hit on Western society the most if the frequency of resistance increases more. Okay. Just to mention a few things about pathogens versus normal flora. These are numbers that you probably are aware of. So we have this microflora, it's about 10 times more cells than we are made up of. It's about 3 million bacteria genes that are carried on us, mostly in the intestine. And this is a very vital area at the moment, looking at this normal flora and its involvement in a number of things. So it's important for development, for nutrition, for defense, for immunity, and so on. An important thing to remember is that many significant pathogens are actually commensals of normal flora. So this distinction between a pathogen and normal flora is not really straightforward. Many of them are actually normal flora. And with regard to antibiotic treatments, you will always get a collateral effect on the normal flora when you treat. So there are a number of studies that have shown that if you as an individual would take a normal antibiotic treatment, let's say for a week, the resistance, the frequency of resistant bacteria in your intestine or on your skin or on your nasopharynx is going to increase, and those resistant bacteria might stay around for years without further selective pressure. So they can be selected and they can stay there for very, very long time. And taking this into account, that also means that the risk of you getting infected with your own resistant normal flora is increased.
So when you're on an antibiotics course, maybe the penicillin, say, how do these numbers change, right? 10 to the 10 per gram?
They don't change very much. It's kind of a redistribution. Some of them, it all depends on the bacterial phyla or species you're looking at. Some are not affected at all. Some go down and some increase in response to other going down. So it all depends on which one you're looking at.
But so when there's sort of an empirical antibiotic treatment, you just take some sort of broad spectrum drug, sort of, and hope you knock down that part of the distribution that causes the problem.
Yeah, I mean, the effect on the normal flora, that's kind of that's the collateral damage that you really don't want, right? You tailor your treatment to hit the pathogen that you're interested in, but as a side effect, you're always going to get the effect on the normal flora and resistance development in that normal flora. So that's always going to happen, and it's really very difficult to get around. And of course, this is going to be a driver in the long term of the resistance problem, because you're accumulating more resistant bacteria that potentially can cause problems later on. Yes?
But we haven't yet reached the point yet then where, you know, it's perfectly normal for your flora to be resistant. Because as a child, you pick it up from presumably your parents and environment.
Oh, I mean, if you would sample all of you in this room and pick out E. coli and look for resistance to the most common antibiotics, you would probably all have some fraction of resistance to, let's say, aminoglycosides, tetracyclines, trimethoprim, fluoroquinolones. The fractions are probably quite low, but they are there. They are there at some frequency. And that's a consequence of you having had treatments with antibiotics, but most of you will have had that during some time. And also transmission, of course, from other people with resistant bacteria. So both of those are going to contribute to that.
And yeah. Low fraction means 10^-7?
I mean, we have measured this for E. coli. 10^-4, -5, -6 out of a total population, perhaps, of, you have about 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 E. coli per gram of feces. So about 10 to the 9, 10 to the 10 total population of E. coli in your whole intestine. So it's an appreciable number of resistant bacteria. And of course, as soon as you put on a selective pressure, you're going to pull that population up and select for it. Yes.
So, this might be wrong, but I was under the impression that antibiotic treatment did actually reduce the overall number of bacteria, and that's why you also get this expansion of fungal species. So if there's not just a change in the composition of bacterial species, why does that actually affect fungal resurgence of fungal species?
Yeah, let me modify that a bit. It depends. I mean, in certain places, you can get reduction in the total number, but most of those effects are really reduction in kind of key species. Yeah. for example, if you look at vaginal infections in relation to, or urinary tract infections in relation to antibiotic treatment, you know that you suppress normal flora, and that actually increases your risk of getting a new infection. So the risk of getting a new urinary tract infection after you've had a treatment is 5 to 10 times higher than before the treatment. And that's because you have this collateral effect of the antibiotic on the normal flora.
How much does the resistant population decline over time if you haven't been exposed to antibiotics?
It all depends on the pathogen and the resistance, but we have looked at these in enterococci, in staphylococci and skin, and we have followed people up to 4 years. And after 1 week of treatment, some of these patients still have resistant bacteria, even though they have not had an additional antibiotic treatment during these 4 years. So there has not been any further selective pressure. So 1 week of treatment, enrichment, and those stay around for at least 4 years. So they can hang around for very, very long times. Yes.
Sorry, can I ask that last question? So for sure should be familiar with these streptomycin-treated mice, this model of colonization, they don't have to give this antibiotic before the colonization. So for instance, with E. coli, at least in our experience in our lab, it does not work. You cannot divide, you cannot colonize the mice if you don't put it.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a clear idea of what are we doing and with this? Disturbing the
microbiome? No, I think it's the same as for the urinary tract infection. That you have for your infection to take, you basically have to get rid. You have to streptomycin treat to get rid of part of the normal flora. Otherwise, your incoming bacteria will not take in that mouse.
So supposedly, these mice
will
have some percentage of E. coli in their normal flora. That is streptomycin resistant, this would not take increasing frequency and prevent further.
They could. I mean, that's something that's always a worry when you use. But it depends on where you get your mice from. If they are really free of resistant bacteria. And that's really something you, when you do that kind of experiment, you would have to test that on your supplier of mice. We have looked at this, and it depends on where you buy your mouse. It's some of them will be in, have a resistant flora, some will not. So it's
because this specific pathogen we list, it says some particular strains, but not resistance.
Yeah.
Right?
I wouldn't trust what you get from the company too much. I would actually check that myself, especially if your results are kind of varying.
Now we always wonder what exactly are we doing when we do this.
I would test that because it's pretty straightforward to test. So, yeah. Okay. Where are we? Antibiotics. Okay, so I'm going to say a little bit about use and targets and drugs and types of drugs and mode of action just to introduce you again to this. And just some class of definitions here. This is kind of the classical definition. So it's an antibiotic, something produced by a microorganism. Today we kind of define it as a small molecule. It can be either natural or synthetic that inhibit growth of another organism. And if we look at what are antibiotics used for, and this is, I'm always blown away by this number. We use about It's kind of hard to get good numbers here because we don't really know. But we use at least 500,000 tons of antibiotics per year globally. And about one third of that is used in human medicine. It might even be less than this. And of that, about 90% in the community and 10% in the hospital. So the total antibiotic use, about 3% is in the hospital setting. About two-thirds are used for animals, and most of that is for husbandry, and most of it is for preventive use and growth promotion to increase meat production. Some is plant production and aquaculture and so on as well, but most is really for growth promotion. And what's interesting also, and this is something I'm going to talk further about later 2 weeks from now in the research seminar, is about the effect of these antibiotics. Because when we or an animal eat antibiotics, on average about 50% of that dose is going to be excreted in urine, mainly in urine, some in feces, but mainly in urine, in an unchanged active form. And that is going to come out, and it's going to come out in wastewater and sludge, it's going to come out in manure, and it's going to end up in lakes, rivers, and soils. And we cannot tend to, and I'm going to talk more about that, we have focused a lot on resistance development in the hospital setting. If we look at the total use, it's only about 3%. It's a very strong selective pressure in this environment, because basically every second patient will get antibiotics when they are in the hospital. But if you look at the total volume of use, this is really a minor part. And I think we have to distinguish here between where resistance emerges and where it's transmitted. And there is no question that hospitals are kind of transmission hubs for resistant bacteria. But I would say probably most of our resistance problems are not emerging here. They're emerging at other places. They might emerge here, they might emerge out here. And I think it's likely, actually, that they, for many pathogens, actually occur or emerge in these environments. And then they are transmitted back to these type of environments. Yes.
How much is known about the route from bugs from the environment back into humans?
Very little. That's I'm going to mention a little bit at end. And that's kind of the problem with these kind of figures and ideas, that to get the epidemiological data showing that the problem is generated here and transmitted back to an animal or human is really difficult. But the data are coming in, and we see more and more examples of that happening. I mean, it's really difficult to quantify. No one can do that today. How much of the problem is originating here, how much is originating here, and how much is originating here. But I think we should be careful putting so much focus on the hospitals, because my guess is that that's really not where the problems emerge. It's where they are transmitted. But the emergence is at other places.
How large are the concentrations of antibiotics in those lakes, rivers, and soils? I mean, that depends obviously on the...
Yeah, I mean, they are typically well below what's called a minimal inhibitory concentration, the MIC, for the bacteria. So the selection here is what we call sub-inhibitory. It's below the MIC.
But can you take, like, a bucket of water and grow bacteria, or use it to select...
Yes, I'm going to talk about that later, but we have done that kind of experiment, and you can see antibiotic concentrations, for example, if you look at the wastewater at the sewage plant in Uppsala, and we are a country that uses a lot of, or a little of antibiotics, so we generally have weak selective pressures, but even that water contains enough of some antibiotics to confer a selection and enrich for resistant bacteria. So the concentrations can be high enough to select.
So how does one compare the antibiotics to naturally produced antibiotics, in soil bacteria, fungal bacteria? Presumably, that is some gigantic amount, but probably differently distributed.
Yeah, it's not in an aquatic environment. The naturally produced is very, very low. I mean, most of that naturally produced antibiotics are at very low concentration, and typically it's produced mainly in soil, like mycetes, and a lot of it is bound to clay and so on, and it's not really free antibiotic. So in this context, I think the selective pressure conferred by kind of natural production is very, very low.
Even in soil?
Perhaps in certain soils, but in an aquatic environment, I would say it's probably not an important selector. And if you look at manure, for example, that you would put on a field, or sludge that you get from a wastewater that you would put on a field, the concentration of some antibiotics, like for quinolones, so it can be enormously high. I mean, it can be much higher than this under certain circumstances. So there you definitely have you can even have strong selective pressures in these kind of environments.
So excuse me? Yeah. So if you have bacteria that live in the human gut,
mm-hmm.
it's not obvious to me how they would even survive out there, right? Like in the environment, like outside of the human body, right? Anaerobic and so on and so forth.
Oh, it depends on what. I mean, some pathogens, of course, are. If you look at, let's say, Helicobacter pylori, that's a human-specific pathogen. We don't really know of any other reservoir. So, but if you look at E. coli, for example, antibacterial also. If you look at Staphylococci, Streptococci, they can survive outside the body. So you can have a cycle of transmission from air, for example, to there, to out here, and back. Into humans and animals.
So in this case, the thinking is that really the same exact bacterium is out there than living in a population or something. Somebody acquires resistance, then you eat it up, and then this is resistant in your body. It's not like there are plasmids being exchanged between the bacteria and then.
No, it's clonal transmission of specific clones that move between these types of environments.
There have been any studies on sort of displacement, so like in the human body taking probiotics or in any of these waste facilities actually growing up bacteria that aren't resistant. That works.
The whole probiotic field is it's kind of difficult. I eat probiotics myself, not because of scientific reasons, but because I do it because I believe it. No, it's. I think the data that supports that it has kind of a good effect.
But it's clear, Don, that it stunted your growth.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah. I started eating actually when I was fully grown. it's kind of. I don't think the data is strongly supporting that you get a strong effect of when you eat. Yogurt, for example, with probiotics, that's going to...
No one's done these like four-year studies where you
probiotics. There are studies, but they are not, the effects are generally quite small and often not significant, I would say. But yeah, I mean, if you like yogurt, you could.
I was wondering because I actually was under the impression that especially for the more recently developed antibiotics, the resistance actually grows very quickly after they came out of a phase 3 trial or something. So in this setting, there would actually not be any large-scale usage of the antibiotics mm-hmm. before the resistance arose, which would, make the argument that it actually comes from from food production or something.
This reasoning, of course, it's all dependent. It's kind of pathogen specific, right? So in some cases, you will have resistance development in the animal or in the patient that's being treated. But I would say in many cases, it's probably not there where resistance is developing. And you have to kind of distinguish here between mutational resistance, which is kind of the exception. A lot of evolutionary biologists, we study mutational resistance, but from a medical perspective, that's really the least interesting. It's not the most common. In Mycobacterium tuberculosis, it's all mutational resistance, and then you have mutational resistance for fluoroquinolones. But almost all other types of the most clinically important resistances, they are carried by plasmids or transposons. So that means the resistance, when you're infected, you're either infected with the resistant bacterium or you're not. And if you're not, resistance is not going to develop because there is no gene there that would confer resistance. So really this resistance evolution during treatment, that mostly applies to those like MTB and perhaps drugs like fluoroquinolones. It's a mutational pathway taking you to resistance.
But you said that a lot of the, when the intestinal flora and the potential fraction have resistant plasmids.
And they can
in them. But you think that it, believe that that mechanism of change from plasmid from one of those into the pathogen is relatively rare. That's not what dominates.
Yeah, I mean, that's what the genomics from Morton Summer and others told. But if you look at the you will find resistance genes in intestinal bacteria, but there seems to be a kind of a strong compartmentalization here. The transfer rates to human pathogens is not that high. It depends a bit on which commensal you're looking at, but generally it's not a high rate. Yes?
I have a question. What's on your next slide?
Sorry. I don't know. Should we see? Okay, I'm going to go through a little bit about antibiotics and targets, because I think this is also important for coming discussion. So what is a good antibiotic target? So first, it has to be an essential function. And of course, you're going to say, what about virulence inhibitors? And you can say that, but I'm not going to bring it up. But generally, it's going to be an essential function. And if you look at something like E. coli, it's about 300 essential genes. So you have about 300 targets. The second thing, it's going to be a complex function, preferably. So your target should preferably not be a single enzyme. Single enzymes are generally not good targets for antibiotics for several reasons, and I'm going to get back to that. So the more complex, I would say, the better. That is, and the reason for that has to do with the number of components in your pathway or your system that is druggable, that is, you can direct the drug to it, but it also has something to do with resistance development. So that tells us that protein and cell wall biosynthesis, those are really the major targets for antibiotics. And this kind of summarizes targets in the antibiotic targets. And what's marked here is protein synthesis and cell wall synthesis. And it's different classes of antibiotics. And these are kind of outstanding. All the other targets are, in comparison, not very interesting. We have some that, like trimethoprim and sulfonamides, that work on folic acid metabolism. We have the rifampin, that's used mainly for tuberculosis, that is directed at RNA polymerase. We have fluoroquinolones that act on DNA gyrase. But that's about it. The major targets are protein synthesis and cell wall biosynthesis.
Has anybody tried to target plasmid reproduction?
Yes. And it doesn't work well. Because it's hard to find. I mean, there are several reasons for that. I don't believe it in as a basic concept, because I don't think that's going to. You still have to give that together with something else, right? How would you
use it in conjunction with another antibody?
And it's kind of built on the assumption that resistance appears during treatment because of horizontal gene transfer. And I also told you that in most cases, that's not the case. So I think that kind of drug is not.
And there are too many classes of reproduction mechanisms as well as
plasmids.
Pardon? There are too many different ways.
Yeah, it's a very complicated target, because there are so many ways of replicating. So to find a common kind of way of inhibiting plasma transfer is difficult. But these are really the two ones that are the most important ones. I'll get to that in a second. So I'm going to say a little bit about what these drugs are doing. Should we take a break, or should we?
I think so. There's supposed to be sort of two coffee dispensers, but I don't think they're there yet.
Okay,
so let's go on for another half
hour. I'll continue.
So excuse me. So bacteria need to do quite a bit more than this, right? They need to divide. They need to do cytoskeleton. Blah 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 blah. Mm-hmm. So why don't we target all that stuff? Like so random thought is all of them need to, you know, make cytokinesis or something. Right, so they need to separate the daughter cells, right?
Yeah, I mean, some, as I told you, there are about 300 essential genes. So in principle, there are 300
right.
targets. But it turns out the majority of them, if you take out these, are single enzymes. And they are not really good targets. And one reason is resistance development. That, and I'm going to get to that. Why are these, especially the ribosome, a good target from the point of view of resistance development? Also partly the cell wall biosynthesis. But so let me tell you a little bit about, this is a ribosome. It doesn't look good, but this is the way it looks. So there's a small subunit. It's kind of a weird projection here because the action, of course, is in the interface between these subunits. But here you have the decoding, so this is the mRNA. You have three sites here, the A site, the P site, and the X site. And this is where the decoding of the mRNA occurs. And then you have the peptide coming out here in the 50S subunit via a channel in that subunit. And basically all drugs that act on the ribosome, they bind to ribosomal RNA. So they either bind to 23S ribosomal RNA in the large subunit or to 16S ribosomal RNA in the small subunit. So if you take a class of drugs like the macrolides, erythromycin, for example, is a common one, it binds to 23S RNA, and it binds here in this channel. So it kind of causes a molecular constipation in a way. So it sits here and prevents the peptide from coming out of the 50S subunit. Chlorpheniclone binds to 23S ribosomal RNA in this region, so this is the kind of the decoding site, and it interferes with peptidyl transfers, so the transfer of the peptide to the A site when you translate proteins. Another class, and this is one of the few new classes of drugs that's come in the last few years, oxazolidinones, binds 23S ribosomal RNA, prevents formation and joining of these two subunits, and it also prevents binding of charged tRNA to the A site. Same for the 30S subunit. Binds to 16S aminoglycosides, 16S inhibits translocation from A to P site, causes misreading. Tetracyclines, prevents binding to the A site. So the kind of the action for most of these drugs, with the exception of macrolides that kind of stop the growing peptide from coming out, is in the decoding site. So we do the actual decoding, and we also do the peptidyl transfer and the translocation. But these are in all of these classes, there is no cross resistance between them. So they have unique binding regions and targets in this decoding site. And there are also other antibiotics. These are not so important, but antibiotics that inhibit translation factors. So fusidic acid, for example, inhibits elongation factor G, which is involved in the translocation step on the ribosome. Mepirocine, it binds to amino acid tRNA synthetase that's involved in charging tRNA with an amino acid. Okay.
Do any of the ribosome, the RNA binding ones, have any substantial specificity as to what the RNA sequences?
Yeah, some of them have very high specificity. So you can pinpoint specific nucleotides that are essential for binding of the
RNA. But those are nucleotides which some bacteria will have and some not? Or are they just the very highly conserved?
Highly conserved, generally, yeah. So if you look at macrolides, for example, it's kind of a broad spectrum type of class of drugs. It's often an alternative if a patient has penicillin allergies. Penicillin or cephalosporins would be the first choice, but the second choice would be a macrolide. So it's a broad spectrum type drug. Okay.
Do any of these have the side effects in eukaryotes?
Yes, they do. From that perspective, I mean, kind of the, and I'll get to that as well, but I mean, the general rule when you look for a target is to look for something that's not present in the eukaryotic cell. But this is kind of the wonderful exception, because we have ribosomes that are very similar to bacterial ribosomes. So some of the side effects, for example, of aminoglycosides, they are related to effects on mitochondrial ribosomes. But what's interesting with this, and if you have followed this, the whole discussion about new drugs, finding new drugs, there was this enormous focus on finding new targets from the, let's say, the mid-90s and up to quite recently. The whole genomics did that for us. People thought, oh God, now we're going to sequence genomes. We're going to find thousands of new targets and we're going to solve this problem. And basically hasn't given anything. There's not a single drug, in terms of antibacterial drugs, that's on the market based on that genomics approach. And what it really told us, and the academic researchers jumped onto this, the industry jumped onto this, is that the problem is not targets. It's not lack of targets that's limiting discovery of new antibiotics. It's really something else. It's actually a major obstacle is that we don't have the substances. We don't have compounds. We don't have compound libraries to find good drugs. That's the major limiting factor. It's not lack of targets. And I think the ribosome is a very nice illustration of this. If I would go into drug development, which we are kind of doing at the moment, I would choose the ribosome, which we're also doing, because it's not a saturated target. It's a completely validated target. It's a good target. But there are perhaps tens, I don't know, not hundreds, but there are probably lots of additional druggable sites on the ribosome. So if you look at the ribosomes, there are other sites in that region of the decoding region where you could find that are not overlapping with the existing drugs, that you could find drugs that bind. And then we have the whole set of factors. There are no drugs, oh sorry, this would be EFTU, that's wrong. There are no drugs against EFTU or EFTS. There are no drugs against the three initiation factors. There are no drugs against the two termination factors. And we only have one drug, mepiracin, against one out of 20 amino acid TRNA synthetases. So there are lots of potential targets in the ribosome that are not really explored. Yes?
The streptomyces produce about 5,000 different antibodies, including chloroquinicol. Most of them, the ones both that we use, are working on the ribosome, streptomycin, chloroquinicol, cycline, and so on. Have they really exploited, they say many of them are toxic. Have they really exploited those 5,000 antimicrobials? And I guess that's the way they found them in the old days, by zones of inhibition.
Yeah. I think the aminoglycosides are problematic because they have side effects. They are difficult to handle, and you have to give them intravenously. There are no aminoglycosides in oral form, and they have side effects that are serious. And I know that. People have found aminoglycosides that bind to other sites, but most of them fall through because they have toxicity or pharmacokinetic properties that are not good.
No, I think it's something, yeah, I agree that there's side effects. But we've been working now with three streptomyces, and they produce so little antibiotic that if in fact you search for them by looking for zones of inhibition, right. You'll get negative results.
Right.
But if you had another assay for biological activity, not zones of inhibition, I'm wondering whether you could get more. Get the cyclines, the chloramphenicols, and not all just aminoglycosides. Just your point is really well taken, that it's not not an absence of targets, it's an absence of compounds.
I mean, there's a whole industry doing this with biosynthetic pathways, right? Where you, with catalytes and also with aminoglycosides, where you kind of take the existing pathways and you kind of scramble them, and then you hope for to find something, a novel structure of an that's formed from existing enzymes and pathways. To my knowledge, that has not given anything that's even close to clinical trials, but I think it might be a good approach. But again, I mean, aminoglycosides are difficult because they're complex structures, and they are, from a medicinal chemistry point of view, they are not easy to kind of play around with and modify. It's difficult chemistry to modify aminoglycosides. So. Okay. Coffee or continue? Continue. Okay. I'm fine. I'm just worrying about you. Okay. Cell wall synthesis inhibitors. So this is something that you should know from basic bacteriology. This is a gram negative, this is a gram positive. This one has two membranes, an outer and inner membrane, and it has a thin peptidoglycan layer in between, about 2 nanometers, about 20% of cell weight. Gram-positive has this thick peptidoglycan, can be up to 10% of the length of the cell, actually, and about 90% of the cell weight, and it doesn't have an outer membrane. And the basic building block now of this cell wall is this. So it's this disaccharide, N-acetylglucosamine, N-acetylmuramic acid, and linked to that is a short peptide chain. So this is the building block that builds up the peptidoglycan. So these are the alternating sugars, chains like this, and they are cross-linked via these peptide chains. So that builds up the...
So the gram stains exactly this peptidoglycan layer?
Yeah, I mean, the gram staining is based on the retention of a dye, crystal violet. So you give, if you stain, you give crystal violet, that will stain. And then you add iodine, that will react with the crystal violet and form a bigger complex. And then you rinse with acetone or ethanol. And in gram negative, the peptidoglycan is very thin, so it will just be rinsed away. In gram-positive, this complex of crystal violet and iodine will be stuck in the peptidoglycan. So it will be stained in the staining. So that's the basic for the staining.
And so there's this two things. Is it also a deep phylogenetic division, or is it positive-negativeness scattered?
I mean, there is a phylogenetic basis for this. The firmicutes, they are gram positives, and they are kind of a distinct phyla in the, if you look into phylogenetics of your bacteria.
It's a related question. In this picture, the stuff sticking out in the membrane is very, very different in both cases. Is it just artistic license, or is the
Yeah, they have different colors.
So the protein complement of so on the outside completely.
Yeah, different. I mean they are very different in terms of the surface. So if you look at a gram negative will have a lipopolysaccharide in the outer membrane, that a long chain that's sticking out here of also alternating sugars. It has nothing to do with the peptidoglycan, and that you will not find on the gram-positive. So the surface is completely different if you compare a gram-positive and a gram-negative.
So that also means the transmembrane receptors are completely different in these two classes of bacteria.
I mean, if you look at the cytoplasmatic membranes, I mean, there are differences between them, but I don't think there you would find necessarily any systematic differences. But I don't know, actually. If there is any, I mean, the difference here is that you have an outer membrane. So anything, which you of course don't have here, but in terms of any signaling occurring over the inner membrane. I don't know if they are, they are probably different, but I don't know if they are kind of systematically different that you can say that this is a membrane, inner membrane from gram positive and this is from gram negative. I don't think that's the case. But.
So all these extracellular receptors, for example,
I mean, it depends on the molecule here, right? It's you have to remember that the peptidoglycan generally for smaller molecules is not very much of a diffusion limit. So it's you have to have rather big molecules to kind of know. But the peptidoglycan is going to be something that stops diffusion. The main difference with regard to that is the outer membrane. And that's also the reason why it's so much more difficult to find antibiotics towards gram-negatives than gram-positives, because you have two membranes. And the requirement on the drug are completely different when it comes to transport over these membranes, because to get over the outer membrane, the drug is going through pores. So these are aqueous channels, so you have to have a hydrophilic part to the molecule, but to get over the inner membrane, you have to have some lipophilic properties. And it's the balance between those that's really difficult to build into a chemical that's supposed to inhibit the gram negative.
Do we have any idea which of these types are older?
Older.
The gram positive is a tiny minority, right? It's one group. The gram negative is everything else.
Well,
there's a huge asymmetry.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know.
You've got one layer would come before two.
I don't know if the phylogenal bacteria has been rooted in such a way that you can say. I don't think so. But
so excuse me, how many bacteria do we know which are neither one?
Which are neither one?
Oh.
Yeah, mycoplasmas. Mycoplasmas are kind of different. They wouldn't be classified in.
But it must be, right? Because the definition is
you get
too
collar
under some stain.
Right.
Right. But the basis for it
wasn't necessary. There are also nice pictures, yeah. So I'm wondering, right?
No, but there is a kind of a assignment that's called indefinite. So there is a reasonable sized group of bacteria that you couldn't assign them being gram positives or gram negatives. Okay, so these are the inhibitors that act on the main groups. So we have beta lactams. So there we have the penicillins, the cephalosporins, and the carbapenems. We have this particular drug that's not used very much, glycopeptides like vancomycin and fosfomycin. And this kind of is the whole pathway for cell wall biosynthesis. There are steps in the cytoplasm, there are steps of transport and biosynthesis in the cytoplasmatic membrane, and then there are also steps on the outside, and you end up with this peptidoglycan. So phosphomycin acts on this first step here, paclitaxel acts here, glycopeptides act here, and beta-lactams, they act on the cross-linking. So the cross-linking of the two peptide chains, that's what the beta-lactams inhibit. And all beta-lactams have this common beta-lactam ring. And what beta-lactamases do is that they open up this ring, and that will inactivate the antibiotic. But the important point from this is that you can see there are a number of steps here, and the same thing applies to cell wall biosynthesis. It's not a saturated target. So there are several steps in precursor biosynthesis, at least 8 genes here that are involved in these various steps that don't yet have antibiotics directed against them. So I would argue that cell wall biosynthesis is still also a good target, and that there are plenty of enzymes here that could potentially be used. Okay. continued. Now we're coming back to this list. You probably forgot this list, but what is a good expected target? So complex function, we talked about that. Target, preferably not present in humans. Cell biosynthesis, that's true, but protein synthesis, it's definitely there. And it's still a very, very good target. There's also some called the therapeutic index, and what you want is selective toxicity here, right? So if you look at the effect, it's a function of dose. The concentration where you get some effect on the bug should be much lower than the toxicity effect. And kind of a rule of thumb that people in the industry go after is that the difference between these concentrations should be at least 50-fold. So the concentration where you start getting negative effects on your host or host process or enzyme should be at least 50-fold higher than where you get selective toxicity on your bacteria.
Are there regulations about this therapeutic window, how big it has to be? Is that the rule of thumb?
No, I mean, if it is small, it's difficult. You really have to, it's more, definitely more difficult to get it through FDA or something similar. It's overlapping, right? it's basically the same. And that's what's so interesting with cancer chemotherapy is that there we have a completely different requirement because that window can be, they can be just next to each other. Preferably bactericidal effect of inhibiting target. So again, some definitions here. We distinguish between what's called bacteriostatic drugs. So they don't kill the bacterium, they just stop growth. Tetracycline, chlorpheniclone are good examples of that. And bactericidal, and the bugs will be killed. And of course, from the point of view of resistance development, it's generally better with a bactericidal drug. But also in some cases, you don't want a bactericidal drug because, for example, for a gram negative, if you have a septicemia, a blood infection, if it's a strongly bactericidal drug, you might actually release a lot of LPS and you might get negative effects on the host because of it being kind of too bactericidal. So there are special situations where bactericidal is not necessarily good. But generally, people are looking rather for bactericidal than bacteriostatic drugs. The last point, and this is something I'm going to talk more about later as well, is a low propensity for resistance development. And I mentioned three things, so I'm just going to briefly go through them. So a target that's encoded by several genes, or where you have multiple targets for the drug, those are generally good ones from the point of view of resistance development. So this is the reason why the protein synthesis drugs are good. Because in most bacteria, the ribosomal RNA is encoded by several separate genes. So in E. coli and Salmonella, you have 6 or 7 ribosomal RNA operons, and that's the target. Ribosomal RNA. So that means if you get the mutation in one copy that gives you resistance because of the target alteration, the sensitivity is going to be dominant in that strain because you still have 6 operons that produce susceptible RNA. So you really have to mutate all the copies, and that will slow down resistance development for that kind of drug. Let me go through this and then I'll get back to this list. So for me, this is a useful way of thinking about this. If you think about resistance development, so if you think about this as a mutational space, so the number, so each circle here would represent a given mutation or a horizontal gene transfer event that would give resistance to a certain antibiotic. And it's really three things that will determine the probability of resistance development here. So one is the effect of the resistance on fitness of the bacteria. So the susceptible wild type is up here, high fitness, no resistance. It's the rate of formation. So that's the mutation rate or the horizontal gene transfer rate. And the different sizes of the circles indicate that. And then the resistance level. So if you have a situation like this, this is kind of bad news for a drug. If your mutational space looks like this. So let's say there are 25 different possible solutions that could give you resistance to that drug. And some of them give you high level resistance without not much effect on fitness of the bacteria. This is not what you want. So a drug, that's good if the mutational space looks something like this, would be much better. So the mutation rate to resistance is low. The effect of any resistance gene or mutation on fitness is high. So we have a reduced fitness. And the increase in resistance is not that high.
You're talking about fitness in the absence of the drug, right?
In the absence of the drug in this case, yes.
Has anyone had success making chimeric molecules that artificially target two proteins?
Yeah, there are lots of people working on that. Yeah, it depends on what you mean with success. I think there are might be some that are in early phase one clinical trials, perhaps. That's based on this that you have, like fluoroquinolones, for example, is that type of drug, right? Because the fluoroquinolone acts on both topoisomerase 2, which is the DNA gyrase, and topoisomerase 4. Still, the rate of drug resistance development to fluoroquinolones is pretty high. But so from a kind of a generalization perspective, what you're looking for in terms of the rate of formation, the ones that would probably give you the lowest rates is that you, when you have multiple drug targets for the drug, or your drug target is encoded by multiple genes, and then you have this reasoning with your ribosome RNA. Yes.
So these multiple genes is saying if there are multiple copies, it's harder that all mutate, right?
Yeah.
But it's easier that any mutates.
Yes, but the point of it is that it's going to be the susceptible phenotype that's going to be dominant in this case. So
right, so it depends whether they are transcribed all the same or whether the bug is smart enough to, you know.
Yeah, but for ribosomal RNA, they have to. They transcribe them all as much as they can under rapid growth. So in principle, for ribosomal RNA, you would have to have that mutation in all 6 or 7 ribosomal RNA operons. But there are exceptions. Mycobacterium tuberculosis, for example, only has 1 ribosomal RNA operon. And there you also find mutations in the ribosomal RNA that give you resistance to aminoglycosides. But in E. coli or Salmonella, you wouldn't find that because you would have to have the mutation in all copies. And that would be a very slow process to get that. Yeah.
You mentioned a couple of slides before that mutational resistance is extremely rare to occur within patients. It only occurs for 2 drugs or something like that.
If you do the monotherapy with fluoroquinolones, you have a
so,
risk.
So the reason it doesn't occur is because you typically need multiple mutations to get resistance, or because you're protected by these 2 mechanisms.
Yeah. So the rate of formation of the resistance mutations is lower when you would have this situation, for example, if you have one target gene.
With the fluoroquinolone, since you have 2 mutations in the serum, generally thought, you know, for many species you have 2 mutations for resistance. And when you do the modeling or even do the experiments, you could get chloramphenicol resistance to ciprofloxacin in one passage.
Because you're selecting for intermediates, and so this sort of bullshit idea that you need a product of two mutation bases is false, because you're selecting for intermediates. So it's so easy to get chloroquinolone resistance.
The
thing is, they often don't have much cost. Not always, but sometimes they don't.
No, it's a good point, because it's I mean, the assumption here, if you have multiple targets and that the probability of getting it should be the product, there would be that they're all equally rate limiting for growth. And that's almost never the case. One is going to be more limiting, and that's where you're going to get your first resistance mutation, because you have selection on that. And when you get that, you get the second one. So it's really a stepwise selection.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be a nice exercise in the class to just sort of take 10 to the 9 cells and start growing them up in class with way above MIC ciprofloxacin and watch resistance evolve, and even though you have two mutations in the cohort. And it is impressive just to see how easily you get resistance to the chloroquinolones. You know, when they first came out, Bio was sort of saying this is misleading everybody.
And there was another aspect to that, and that is the probability argument is built on the mutational distribution being random in the chromosome. So if you have a target where you need two mutations, if mutations form in cluster, and we know they do form in cluster because the error-prone polymerase gets on and makes have high mutation rates and they form a cluster, then it's not going to be the product of the two independent rates because the mutations are clustered. So it's actually going to be a much higher rate than the product. And that's also going to kind of make that argument more complicated. But I think
it would be kind of a fun exercise to look at the dynamics of formation where you know you have two mutations, and it'd be really easy to do.
But somehow it appears it really depends on the intermediate fitness landscape. In principle, if you have like six genes, you have also six times as many mutations that can happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then is there selection on the first? What happens if the first has happened and so on? So depends on that whole mountain, doesn't it?
Yeah, and there, Isabel has some interesting data. I hope you will talk about on epistatic effects between different types of resistance mutations. And
any good antibiotic targets in biofilm formation?
People are looking. There are some that are in early clinical trials there is none out on the market, but that's something that people are looking hard for.
Since it seems like the bacteria become more environmentally resistant in that when they're filmed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they need all six of them to grow fast. If you're happy enough growing slow and you only use, say, one of the six or seven algorithms, are those guys more likely to become resistant? Because if they just mutate that one copy, then they're okay.
No, because the reason, if you mutate one copy, that's not going to give you a phenotypic resistance because the susceptibility is going to be dominant. Because you're going to have a mixed population of ribosomes, the majority are going to be susceptible. And when you translate the message. Oh, you mean that the bacteria.
At the expense of growing quickly, they'll just use one of the operons.
They're going to be extremely sick doing that, and you are basically asking for a mechanism that the bacterium would be able to delete or turn off its ribosomal RNA operon. I mean, that would be a strong counter selection against that strain because it would be very sick. Typically what happens is that you get one mutation in one copy and then you get gene conversion events. So that copy recombines with the other copies in the chromosome and transferred that point mutation to those copies. But again, it's a slow process. Gene conversion in bacteria is not very efficient.
Given that, and given enough time, even with somewhat of a poor fitness landscape, what you have to go through some valley before you can have those live resistant, this really seems like the only security is obscurity, right?
Which
generally frowned upon in computer science, for instance. Should we not be trying to target the mechanisms that allow them to accumulate mutations, like through DNA replication? Because that would also be a
I think the problem is the same as for conjugation, but you are really hitting, you're kind of assuming that you appear during treatment and that you can stop that process. If you already have those strains circulating and your resistance problem, it's a clonal problem of transmission. It's not a problem of emergence because they have already emerged. Then I don't think that will help. But if you would start kind of in a virgin situation where you have a completely new drug and a, let's say, an inhibitor that prevents mutation, and if you would give those two together and the resistance pathway would just be mutational, then it might help. But I think it's...
How many antibiotics are there that target DNA polymerase and replication?
None.
Why is that? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a good question. That's people have looked. It's not an easy target to find drugs against. But in principle, it should be a good. I mean, it's a complex target. It's an essential target. It ought to be a good target. But
it would also act against some conjugation thing, which require DNA polymerase for the transfer.
But it might just be that it's too similar to eukaryotes.
No, I don't think it's toxicity that's the main concern. It's just been difficult to find good drugs against DNA polymerase. Okay, Boris, you want to see the next slide? Okay. Okay, so this is, I'm going to talk a bit more about this later. So this was kind of brought up. So it has to do with the fitness effects then of resistance mutations, and this is something
so
we have
started to copy by
we have worked a lot on. Bruce has worked on this. He was kind of pioneering this whole field, and we think it's kind of it's a useful way of looking at resistance evolution as a kind of a two-step process. So first there's a selection for resistance. But since resistance is almost always, there are a few exceptions, associated with a reduction in fitness in the absence of drug, there is a second step of fitness selection. So these bacteria then can compensate for these costs, and this is something we have looked a lot at, the mechanism of this process of compensation. And this can bring up the fitness in some cases to the wild type level, without loss of antibiotic resistance. And basically, this is what we have been doing since the 1940s. When we started using antibiotics on a large scale, most pathogens were here. They were antibiotic susceptible, and we started using antibiotics to develop resistance, and there was also an associated selection for increased fitness of these. And so our antibiotic pressure, what it's doing is basically driving every population in from the left to the right. And depending on your pathogen, we know that some are here already. Some are here, and a few exceptions, and really the only exception I know of, where we have a bacterium that's still here, that's Streptococcus pyogenes, that's still resistant to penicillin. There is not a single case of penicillin resistance described, as far as I know, for Streptococcus pyogenes. That is, you can always treat strep throat with penicillin. And the reason for that, we have looked a bit at that, it seems, so we provoked resistance in Streptococcus pyogenes, that, and we could get them, but they became very sick. So their fitness dropped to such an extent that they would never be able to survive, probably in the clinical setting. So you can make them by mutation in the penicillin-binding proteins, and actually provoke them to get, they become clinically resistant, but they go down here to the floor, and they can apparently not compensate for that. But for most bacteria, this has happened. We have, for example, looked at Helicobacter pylori in individual patients in stomachs. So we start out here, They were treated, and within 3 months, this had happened. So they developed resistance, fitness went down. So we had biopsies from these patients over time. And they became resistant, fitness went down, and then they compensated. The fitness came up again. And this happened in an individual patient within 3 months. So it doesn't have to be years we are talking about here. It can happen very, very quickly. And of course, this process then is related also to what we want from an antibiotic with regard to low propensity for resistance development. This process should be slow, a low mutation rate, the horizontal transfer rate. The reduction in fitness should be as big as possible, and the rate of compensatory evolution should be as slow as possible.
So for these strains that came up in fitness again, it's not possible to drive them out of your body by eating good strains that are still sensitive, but that's fast.
You might.
That's the reason we take probiotics.
No, I like the taste of it. Perhaps you can. I mean.
But was this the measurement you did? You said you measured that they came up again in fitness. So yeah. Did you compete them?
Yeah. So what we it's actually a very nice study, if I may say. it's biopsies from patients. So we took biopsies from stomachs before they started treatment. The population was susceptible. Then they started treatment. We took samples just after treatment, and they were susceptible, and they also had reduced fitness. And this was measured both in vitro and in humanized mice. So we can infect these strains into mice and look at do competition experiments. And then we took later samples after 3 months. They were still resistant, and they have restored their fitness.
Restored to what level?
Almost to the wild-type level.
There's a nice, interesting other aspect of it is often you can't go back again. And that is to say, if you have 2 mutations that give a compensatory mutation, if you then make it susceptible, they have even lower fitness. Yeah. So you end up, for example, Rich Lenski's strains, the ones that run 55,000 generations, they started out streptomycin resistant, and streptomycin resistance is then, and we have shown a tremendous fitness cost. And nevertheless, they remain resistant to streptomycin. And the reason for it is they have a second site mutation, which compensated for the fitness, so that if they then become sensitive again, they have a tremendous fitness cost. So that in 55,000 generations, they started out streptomycin. Then they remain streptomycin. Fortunately, other things. Fortunately for Richard.
Yeah, there would have been more. Yeah. No, that's true. Yeah, and it's kind of a general pattern what we see with this kind of, these are 2 compensatory mutations. That is, when we are here, so we have a resistance mutation and a compensatory mutation, if we remove either of those, fitness goes down. So that means that this is kind of stabilized, as Bruce said, in terms of fitness. Yes.
This presume there. I can imagine situations actually where that resistant mutant, the first one there, that is has low fitness when you compare it to in an antibiotic environment, could actually have high fitness in the context of a host. I think particularly situations where growing fast is not the winning strategy. Mm-hmm. So in the cystic fibrosis lung, for example, we have. Resistance is a major problem. The mutants that come out of the lung actually have a high fitness advantage in the lung by having a very low fitness when you measure them in antibiotic-free media, because growing slow is good news, and also growing slow means you're even more resistant to the antimicrobial compound. And I wonder how often that, when we look at these fitness, decreased fitness mutants, whether in fact they really do have that low fitness cost from the host. I mean, here, when you see compensation, you can well believe it.
Yeah. I think the small colony variant is a good example of that also. So these are mutants in electron transport chain that become resistant to aminoglycosides, for example, and they have problem in Staph aureus. So you have these recurring infections, and they are extremely sick. They grow very slowly. But in the absence of drug, I mean, they are basically, they are growing very slow. But I think you might be right. I think that situation, perhaps the Pseudomonas and perhaps also for small colony variants, that there it's actually a strategy to be very slow growing because that makes you more resistant.
But in the case of cystic fibrosis therapies, I think what is happening in many instances is that not just the Pseudomonas but the Burkholderia and others are being driven to a tuberculosis-like state through therapeutic treatment that makes it almost impossible to eradicate.
Yeah, perhaps it's a more of a concern for kind of chronic type infections that you would see that.
Then is a good place for break or how much?
One more question. So in principle,
it's a good place for break. Yeah, we can break.
It's a good place for
yeah.
A priori, you could expect a correlation that the stronger this fitness cost is, the stronger the fitness selection is after that, and the faster the compensatory mutations appearing. Mm-hmm. Is that observed?
Yeah, I mean, that just follows from the fitness differential here, that if the bigger this is, the faster the takeover.
The faster you drive the population down.
Yeah, I mean, the principal question, I think, is if your fitness differential is bigger, of course, the takeover is going to be faster. But then it's going to depend on if this reduction, if you actually clear the infection, if you get rid of it because of that. But if it's still there, a big fitness differential is going to speed up the rate by which you can get back up here.
Yeah. Also, in this system, is there only one compensatory mutation, or do you actually find a whole spectrum?
That's a good, you brought that up. That's kind of another generalization from this, that when you are here, you can only go back by one mutation, right? That's the only. But you can often go here by a number of different mutations or pathways. So the systems we have looked at, the ratio, perhaps in terms of mutational possibility, might be 50 to 1 or 100 to 1, something like that. So that of course also makes this much more likely to go in that direction and going back.
Okay, so maybe we should give that a break. So when did we reconvene? Say in 20 past?
Yeah. Okay. Let me go back one slide. Just because I forgot mentioning this. Kind of the generalization we can make when it comes to which types of targets are the most interesting from the point of view reducing fitness the most. And that's something we've been looking at and thinking about a lot. And we don't really have a lot here, but if there are kind of two generalizations one can say here, that it seems like the target where there is a high demand on activity, so something again like cell wall activity, cell wall biosynthesis, or a ribosome, the effect on fitness, especially if you get target mutations, are generally bigger than if it's another type of essential enzymes that perhaps it's not limiting for growth under as many conditions, so there is not such a high demand on that activity. Perhaps the more important conclusion is that if the target is such that the mutation is expected to have pleiotropic effects, so again something like the ribosome. So if you get the resistance mutation in the decoding site, you're probably going to affect many different things. You might not just affect binding of RNA to TRNA, but you might also affect the peptidyl transfer reaction or something else. And generally it seems like it's harder to compensate for that kind of mutation. You might compensate one of the effects, but not all of them. So that's really the only thing we can say in terms of more general statements about what's a good target from the point of view of having a high fitness cost associated. Okay.
Don?
Yeah.
It really is, maybe there is an answer, but some of the ones that attack ribosomes are largely bacteriostatic, others are bactericidal. Why is that? They're all reducing protein synthesis, so chloramphenicol is largely static, and the aminoglycosides are cidal. Is there an answer to that?
I think it has to do with, this is just hand waving, but I think the aminoglycosides, because they do different things. They do many different things, actually. The killing effect, I'm going to get to the reactive oxygen species as well in a second. But if you look at the effects on the targets, and aminoglycoside will induce misreading, so you will get more misfolded proteins that will aggregate, and that's probably part of the killing effect. You also get effects, actually, on the actual elongation process of translation. But then there is a second effect of aminoglycosides, and that is that they disrupt the proton motor force. And that, an old argument, I think, from Bernie Davis originally suggested that it's not really the inhibitory effect on the ribosome that the aminoglycosides kill by. The ribosome is just a sink for aminoglycosides going through the membrane and collapsing protein motor force. So if you don't have that sink, less is going through, and you get less effects on the membrane and the protein motor force. But I think it might be that the aminoglycosides are doing several different things, and the protein motor force effect and the misfolding aggregation effect, they could probably be more cidal in nature than just inhibiting elongation or translation. But that's just yes. Okay, other things, I'm not really going to talk about this, but apart from what I mentioned already, it should generally be a broad spectrum, and that's really from the point of view of the physician and the pharmaceutical company developing this, that they want broad spectrum drugs. But of course, this is also a stronger driver of resistance in general, because you're gonna get more collateral damage the more broad the broad spectrum of drug is. And just to show you some examples here, for example, penicillin, cephalosporin is very broad spectrum, they work on both gram negative and gram positives. Tetracycline is one of the most broad spectrum drugs there is. Gram-negatives, gram-positives, and also these chlamydias and rickettsia. And then you have this extreme case, isoniazid. It's only used for treatment of mycobacterium tuberculosis, a very narrow spectrum drug. So if you kind of sum up what kind of drugs are used, and this will be discussed later when we talk more about resistance also. So drugs that act on cell wall and protein synthesis, in terms of total consumption of drug, that's about 80% of all drugs. And if you to that add drugs acting on DNA gyrase, so there's the fluoroquinolones, then you're above 90%. So it's in fact, it's basically used to target cell wall biosynthesis, protosynthesis, and to some extent DNA gyrase. Those are the three major targets. And then you have some others, but they are kind of peripheral drugs. They might be important in certain situations, but they are not kind of the big groups. So I'm going to just mention this. I'm going to bring this up because I think this is a good, just as a suggestion, something we could have a journal club or seminar on, because it's such an interesting problem and there's complete disagreement, which makes it more fun. So how do bacteriocidal antibiotics kill bacteria? And kind of the traditional view, if you look at aminoglycosides, so I mentioned this inhibition of translocation, misreading, disruption of protein motor force. For fluoroquinolones, we know that they generate double-strand breaks in DNA, and that is very difficult for bacteria to repair. Beta-lactams prevents cross-linking and the rupture of the peptidic glycan. And that's kind of what we have lived with for a long time. And then in 2007, Gene Collins suggested another model that kind of unified these three classes of drugs in a common pathway. And they suggested that all of these three, very different drugs with very different targets, the common effect is actually to regenerate reactive oxygen species. So these antibiotics will induce production of reactive oxygen species. This will result in extensive DNA damage, double-strand breaks, and that will be the cause of death. And I think when I first heard this, I didn't believe it at all. And I still don't believe it. But it's really hard to kind of look at the papers and the data. Because there were two other papers last year, one from Imlay and one from Kim Lewis, both in Science. And I just contrasted some of the observations here. And one thing that was missing in this first paper from Collins was, of course, the obvious experiment to test, do these antibiotics kill the bacteria in the absence of oxygen? And this is what Imlay and Lewis did, and they say, no. So killing requires oxygen, no. This model, they say yes. If you look at the papers, the data look perfectly good, and they're completely opposite results. If you look at prediction of the model, is that in the presence of antibiotics, levels of reactive oxygen species, like hydrogen peroxide, for example, should increase. He claimed yes, and they both say no. Increased respiration and levels of free iron in presence of antibiotics, which is also a prediction of the model. Collins says yes, and they say no. Another observation is that if you add iron chelators, so these oxygen radicals, they are generated by the Fenton reaction. So the expectation is that if you add iron chelators or hydroxyl radical scavengers, the pyorrhea, you should reduce antibiotic-induced killing. They say yes, and here they actually agree. They also say yes, but it also does that in the absence of oxygen, saying that the effect of the iron chelator and the pyorrhea has nothing to do with the generation of radicals. It's doing something else. So I'm just going to leave it with this. I think it would be fun to go through these papers and just, because it's you read them and you look at the data, looks fine. Looks fine. And it's completely different in the result in with regard to these kind of key experiments.
Yes, I have some data from So we grew cells in the anaerobic chamber from MRSA and cell cycles, and we found that growth in the anaerobic chamber would sometimes dramatically increase resistance to the lactase, sometimes like a thousand days. But we found that it's dependent on PPGD synthetases. If we knock out the PPGD synthetases, we don't get the increased resistance. Mm-hmm. And so we suspect that what's happening is a stress response is being triggered, mm-hmm. and it has nothing to do with the lack of oxygen.
Okay. Are you going to talk about that? Or? That would be interesting too. I think that this would be fun to go through actually for.
There were two that happened. One was the reactive oxygen species, the other one that the killing is due to DNA damage. And do these people disagree that it's DNA damage?
No, in this last paper, Collins has kind of softened his position. Now he says that, these kind of mechanisms, they are there, and that this is kind of contributing to killing. Because in the first paper, it was kind of all united on this. This was the major cause for the death of the bacteria. So they have kind of softened their position a bit.
But they softened the last part, the extent of the DNA damage.
Yeah.
A different issue. I mean, that.
Yeah, I mean, that they. It's hard to. The extent of double strand breaks you get under the increases you see in hydrogen peroxide is kind of hard to kind of reconcile with the extent of killing you get. And then also the Jim Imlay, which I think is the. I really trust what he's doing in terms of the oxygen. I mean, he claims with the methods he had used that there is actually no increase in hydrogen peroxide with this antibiotic treatment. With direct measurements and also indirect measurements where hydrogen peroxide regulates genes that are responding to hydrogen peroxide. There is no response of those.
You say you're satisfied that both the data are there. Are they using exactly the same systems, the same drugs? Or are they just trying to find evidence?
Same drugs, but there are fine details and differences in conditions.
That was my impression, yeah.
And that might be critical.
Yeah. It is. It would be a fun thing.
I think it would be.
I'm sorry, but generally, I know very little about this, but I'm there. I've seen pictures of, you know, antibiotic treatment of cells. You look under the microscope, and what happens is their cell walls break, they collapse, they fall off, eventually their guts spill out. That's how they die, no?
It depends on the, not for all bacterial sizes,
right?
But for beta lactams, you would could see that.
Yeah. So then, doesn't that just basically say that this theory that all killing is due to reaction to oxygen, that's already known? I mean, it's a question of which happens first.
Yeah, it's. I wouldn't take that as a strong argument. I think this, for me, this is. Depending on what you believe here, right? If this is true, this model cannot be true.
No, that's also true.
Right? But, I mean, because that's kind of the key experiment, for me at least. The others are kind of finer.
I was going to ask the next slide question.
Okay.
I mean, what is the proposed mechanism that double strand breaks in DNA kill the cell? Don't you need to start there? If you're proposing this, do you need to have a mechanism?
I mean, that's well known, that if you get a double strand break in a bacteria, that's because it's a haploid, there's nothing to repair it to. It's only if you have a sister chromatide and you're replicating that region at that point. So if you get the double strand,
that's clear, but not dead.
No, but that's true. But it,
well, that's why I remember we have multiple copies, and apparently some of them can use that.
It is going to be different. So the double strand break generally in a bacterial chromosome means that for the cell.
Sorry, but I
think for Justin to do some direct up on this is the perfect one.
Yeah. Let's do it, Jonathan. We can have pro and con.
I want to insist on this. Because you said before there's a big difference between killing and just stopping replication.
Right.
I understand that double strand breaks stop replication.
Yeah.
Okay, don't kill. Now what you proposed is that double strand breaks are the main high school. I'm just trying to understand what's the logic behind that statement.
You can possibly grow again.
Well, you'll
later,
lose all your super coiling as well, so all your regulations.
Yeah.
I think it's a wonderful question for discussion. So
yeah.
Let's just,
that side, you will support this hypothesis, and this side, you will support this, and then we can have a pro-con kind of human government. That's going to be fun. Okay. Okay, I'm just going to end talking a little bit about, just put some questions in perspective here that what I think are perhaps for me at least, the most important questions in when it comes to resistance evolution. And I'm just going to go through them very briefly. So I've tried to outline them here. So again, where we were some 60, 70 years ago, we were here. So we had susceptible non-pathogens, we had perhaps resistant non-pathogens, and during the last 70 years, we have also made pathogens resistant by mutations and by horizontal gene transfer of resistant genes. And of course, that doesn't generate the problem in itself. It only generates a problem when there is transmission. And what I've listed here are kind of five points that we could discuss further later on or have talks about. But regards the origin of resistance genes, and this is something we really don't know very much about. Where do resistance genes come from initially? Probably they evolved in response to the producers having to have some kind of self-defense against antibiotics. But that's not really the question I'm after. Were they evolved de novo, or were they accepted for metabolic functions? And that's something we don't really know. Where did the resistant pathogens emerge? And we have kind of touched upon this. Where does this happen? Where do you get the horizontal gene transfer of resistant genes, for example? What are the most significant selective pressures driving resistance evolution? And this might be obvious. You might say, of course, it's antibiotics. And that is definitely true, but there might also be other significant pressures. Biological factors influence resistance development. I've already talked a bit about that. And I think this is a key question. What are the flows of pathogens between these kind of three reservoirs? We really don't know very much about those flows, the directions and magnitudes. So I'm just going to bring up some things that you can think about. So two examples here of where probably the resistance genes were kind of accepted for metabolic function. So if we look at resistance to aminoglycosides, so there are different types of modifying enzymes. One class is acetylate modifying enzymes. And these are very common in sugar metabolism. So one example that you all know is the lac A gene that you never use when you do genetics, but it's in there, right? It's acetylation of lactose, and it's still not really clear what it's doing. But I think there's reasonable evidence to believe that these enzymes actually, their initial original function was actually in sugar metabolism. I mean, aminoglycosides are complex sugars. Another example that we have worked a little bit on is beta-lactamases. And there is reasonable evidence for these enzymes actually being evolved from penicillin-binding proteins. So these are the proteins that actually cross-link the peptide chains of the sugar chains in the peptide glycans. So the serine type, the class A, C, and D, the idea is that, and if you look at the chemistry of these reactions, they are identical. So what the beta-lactamase will be doing is to form an acyl enzyme bond here and break this beta-lacto ring. And when you have this, if the water comes in here, you will have a hydrolysis reaction, and this will be a beta-lactamase. The transpeptidase, penicillin binding protein, is doing exactly the same reaction. You get this intermediate of an acyl enzyme. The only difference is that the penicillin binding protein doesn't do the hydrolysis reaction. And if you open up this structure of the penicillin binding protein, you can actually convert it to a beta-lactamase. So if you allow water to enter into the active site of the penicillin binding protein, it can become a beta. So that's one thing. You've already seen this. Where does the resistance emerge? patients, animal waste, water, manure tanks, other environments that we don't really know in most cases where they emerge. Which are the most significant selective pressures? I talked about antibiotics, but one thing that we kind of have ignored up till now are biocides and heavy metals as drivers of resistance development. And if we look at use of biocides and heavy metals, that's even greater than this. It's really hard to get good numbers on this, but it might be tenfold more, it might be a hundredfold more. Biocides and heavy metals are used everywhere in very big amounts.
But in which sense do they drive antibiotic resistance evolution?
Next slide, please. So this is something we have just, hopefully it will be published soon, looking at heavy metals as drivers of resistance evolution. So this is a plasmid we have been looking at. It's a big plasmid, conjugative plasmid. It was isolated from an outbreak at the hospital in Uppsala. 220 kb, about 200 genes, about 20% of those are involved in resistance. So this is a multi-drug resistance plasmid. And as it turns out, on many of these big plasmids, you have resistance operons here to arsenic, to copper, and silver. And since these are on the same genetic element, if you select for these, you're also indirectly going to select or co-select for antibiotic resistant genes that are present in the plasmid. So we have measured here the concentrations of different heavy metals that are needed to maintain this plasmid in the bacterial population. This plasmid has a fitness cost of about 4%. It's not completely stable, so it's lost with a rate of about 10 to the minus 6 per cell per generation. So that means if you have this in a population without selective pressure, it's going to disappear over time. So we have measured basically the selective pressure that's needed to counteract this fitness cost for these heavy metals. And these are the concentrations, 6 micrograms per mL, 0.08 micrograms per mL, and 0.25 micrograms per mL. Now, if you go out in nature and look in different types of environments, out in water supplies or in animals, for example, arsenic, you might not know this, but arsenic is also a growth promoter. So you give that to pigs or cattle, and they grow faster and produce more meat. And if one compound is called roxazole, so that's used in poultry and swine production. And the concentration in feed is about 40 micrograms per mL. So of course now it's going to depend on how this is distributed in the intestine. But it's not unlikely that the concentration then of roxazole that these pigs will get is sufficiently high to select for a bacterium carrying this plasmid. Same for copper and silver. Copper is used, for example, in paints on bolts. Silver, as you know, is present everywhere in household materials and so on. And concentrations of silver can be quite high. So the whole argument about silver being a bad idea is, I mean, it's basically based on this idea that you are co-selecting for antibiotic resistant genes. And this kind of arrangement is pretty common, that you have heavy metal resistant genes on the same plasmid as.
Yes, but yeah, there's no real reason why they would co-occur in the same plasmid, right? Why would they sit on the same plasmid?
That's a good question. I have no.
There's no clue.
You know, what if you find the spectrum of these plasmids, trying to get at questions of whether it's an old plasmid that had those things on, or whether some of those things were on there and then something else came on there, and there's a more recent event that's the problem. Yeah. Assuming something which is.
Yeah, I mean, it's a hard, because you have to have those pre-biocide, pre-antibiotics strains, right?
No, because look at the diversity of this plasmid, and you should see different, if there's different parts of it which are very different, much younger than others, you might.
That's extremely difficult to do with plasmids, because they recombine like crazy, and these are hybrid plasmids, and they have parts from different other plasmids, so to kind of establish a good phylogeny for these kind of plasmids, that's not easy. Yeah.
So I'm wondering if they recombine so heavily, right? I mean, you would have the pressure to making it as small as possible. So if you only would select, for example, now for arsenic, you would expect that at some point there's not much left than maybe the plasmid transfer region and the arsenic mm-hmm. resistance, right? So yeah. you would not necessarily keep the other ones and always cool.
Yeah, we can see that if we take this plasmid, do a long-term evolution in the experiment of the lab, and we keep selection for something just to keep the plasmid there, you get deletions of other regions, and that we can kind of see in real time in the laboratory. So the costs of carrying different parts of these are substantial. We don't really know how these 4% distribute. We think there are some resistance genes in this region that are tetracycline resistance, for example, seems to be one of the most costly ones. But we can see that over a few hundred generations of evolution in the lab that they are thrown out.
These particular heavy metal resistance regions are very well defined, and that are they then kind of mutually exclusive, or are the pathways for heavy metal efflux or digestion similar?
Yeah, I mean, all of these are efflux systems, so the reduction of metal and efflux, but they are not, these are partly overlapping, so some of the silver kind of systems can transport copper, and some of the copper can transport silver. But there is no overlap, as far as I know, to the arsenic system that they transport each other.
Yeah, with respect to these extended spectrum beta lactamases, there are three, right? There's NDM1, OXA, and KPC.
Yeah.
And is it NDM1 that's the completely new class?
Yeah.
The other two are belong to old classes?
I mean, all they've been seen before, yes.
Okay. Yeah. And NDM1 originated in India. Is there any particularly good reason why it came from India?
Are there any Indians here?
there's high levels of arsenic naturally in the water. That could be one reason.
Yeah, it's.
Is it not the cause? The
establishment cause? I mean, India is, from the point of view of resistance development, I think India is the best example you can imagine, because it's a big country. More than 50% of the population defecate out in the, they don't have toilets. They live very close to each other. They have a very high antibiotic pressure. So it's not regulated at all. You can buy antibiotics on the street. You don't have to go to the pharmacist. So they have a very, very high level of unregulated use of antibiotics. And it's a country that is rich enough to be able to give high levels of antibiotics. So if I would think of a country where you would have the best setup with respect to everything, antibiotic pressure and possibility for transmission, that would be India. So all those things are in place there. I'm not sure that's the reason why NDM1 kind of originated there, but I think everything is in place for rapid resistance development. I mean, there are other countries that are similar, but a lot of the kind of the factors you need are there.
So how many of these plasmids do you know where antibiotic resistance genes co-occur with?
Oh, I can't give you a percentage, but it's not uncommon. You can see that quite often. Okay. This I've already talked about, and we will get back to that later. And I'll just end with this one, because this kind of illustrates some data that's really badly needed. And it comes back to the whole question of where does the resistance originate, and how the resistance we have in human pathogens, where did it come from? And it's, this kind of data, of course, is something that the animal industry hates, because it might force them actually to admit that antibiotic use in animals is a problem for humans. I would say that with regard to antibiotic use in animals, we are really at the same situation we were 20 years ago, 25 years ago, when it came to antibiotic use in humans. Because, I don't know, Bruce is probably asleep, but he's probably the only one that remembers this, but, or you're awake.
Yes, I am awake.
Yeah. that 25 years ago, the pharmaceutical industry actually argued that there wasn't any proven correlation between antibiotic use and antibiotic resistance. And as biologists, we know that must be true, right? Otherwise, you have to invent some new biological principles. But that was actually claimed, that there is no solid evidence for that correlation. And in a way, they were true. They were right, because that kind of epidemiological data we didn't have at that time to show that there is a correlation between a strong selective pressure and higher frequencies of resistance. And I would say we're exactly the same situation here now. The industry is arguing, no, we haven't shown that antibiotic use in animals is a problem for human medicine. And again, it's kind of true, because we don't have the epidemiological data, but it's starting to come in. So I'm just going to end mentioning a few examples in this. So this is actually an old study from Holland, where they looked at vancomycin-resistant enterococci and transmission from turkeys to humans. So this is turkey farming. Is it called turkey farming? Breeding? What do you do with turkeys? You farm them.
Free range. Wrong
So you have this nice gradient. If you look at the frequency of VRE, turkeys that, and these are treated, turkeys that have been treated with a, not with vancomycin, but with another drug that's very similar to vancomycin. It's, so when you have used this veterinary medicine, you call them something else, and you think it's another drug, but it's a vancomycin-like drug, and you will get cross resistance to vancomycin. And you have a very high frequency of VLE in these turkeys. If you look at turkey farmers, lower frequency in the intestine, those that slaughter turkeys, even lower in urban residents in this area around the turkey farms, even lower. And they could show that there are clonal relationships between these strains. So you have the selective pressure here, and you have transmission like rings on the border from these turkeys out to the human population. Of course, this is a very suggestive data, right? And saying that it's very likely that this is something that's contributing to the problems we have in humans, but still, we haven't shown that, right? We have shown that there's a gradient here. Now, there's some recent studies that have shown, this is a nice one, that shows MRSA transmission from animals to humans. So this was livestock workers and veterinary students, two studies. So they could clearly show transmission of MRSA from animals to humans. And of course, you could again argue, how do you know that these MRSA that is transmitted from animals to humans are causing clinical problems? If you really want to push this and question the data, right? I think it's obvious that this is a problem. But and then there are other studies, and this is an interesting one, where they actually saw transmission from humans to animals, and this was a methicillin-susceptible staph aureus. And these animals were then treated, and this turned into MRSA. So here, these are clonally related strains. So there was transmission from humans to animals and resistance development in the animals. Unfortunately, in this study, if they had shown this, the next step, that these animals actually had transmitted the MRSA to humans, you had kind of closed the whole circle, right? And these kind of data are starting to come in. And I think this is the kind of data we need to really convince everybody that this is a concern, that antibiotic use in animals is actually driving the problem also in humans. Yes.
Is it driving it, or is it a source of variation? What is,
since it's going back and forth, right? It's
right.
That they are both contributing, so.
I mean, because they were trying to get the blame.
We should blame everybody.
Yeah, blame
except
everybody.
Ourselves.
Yeah, I mean, certainly the physicians want to blame animal use, but it's not animal use that's driving the frequency up in humans. It's certainly a source.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think it has to be separated. Is this, you know, to show that you can transmit and see here and there makes for nice papers, but it doesn't address
That's true. I mean, the problem here is that we can't do a prospective study starting with a kind of a burden situation where everything is susceptible, because that's really what we would like. We have always come in a situation where it's difficult to define the whole flow in any direction it's going, right? We can see certain cases here of flows, but I think you would have to. It comes back to Fernando Baquero's suggestion of an experimental farm. He wants to build an experimental farm where we can do all these experiments. I think that's a good idea.
Stuart Levy did that years and years ago, where he looked at the tetracycline use and he showed it the movement to humans. And you know, so I mean, it's certainly there's no question, and it's sort of obvious that you're going to get it. But the question really is, when you look at, say, MRSA in an American hospital, about 80%, it's not because they're kissing cows. I mean, we're talking about human use, and that's that.
Cow kissing is pretty common, actually. It could be a cow. I wouldn't exclude that. No, but you're right. I mean, it's to show circumstances of this happening, then to put a number on this and saying that this contributes 5% to the problem, or it's 0.1%, that's the difficult thing.
Are all major causes of antibiotics representatives of those used performers? Or are there some groups?
No, some groups, like vancomycin, for example, that has been restricted. So it's been restricted in Europe for now since 2008 or 9 or so. And the FDA introduced some regulation here, but it's not really, it's not regulating it very vigorously, I would say. I mean, that was the way it was for a long time, that you basically had the same antibiotic classes in animals and humans. You just called them something different. The trade name was a different one in animals. And, yeah.
And my understanding is that they're not being deployed for clinical reasons. They're being deployed because they stimulate the growth of the animals.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been in Europe and also in the U.S.
No, it's not in the U.S. It's been banned in, Sweden actually was the first country. We banned already in 1985 all use of antibiotics for animals, and Denmark did it a few years later, and then it's been an ongoing discussion in the European Union forever. And in 2006-07, some countries banned it, and then from 2009 or 10, if I remember correctly, it was banned all over. And what FDA did, a lot of people criticize that because it's really not a ban. There's so many ways to get around it. But,
Recently told me that it's banned in the U.S., but you're saying it's kind of a lot of
loophole. Well, it's complicated because of our animal husbandry approaches that we use here. Almost all the animals are sick, so to some extent you can always justify giving them antibiotics. But there is no ban on it. And the reason that they're getting antibiotics is exactly what, I know this because I live in a rural area, so, but you know, particularly in feedlots and where you're doing these very high intensive animal husbandry, where you're growing animals in confined areas, they almost always have respiratory infections or other kinds of things. So antibiotics are a common practice of using it, technically for health reasons, even though it's not really.
Well, that's a good point. I mean, it's related to the conditions under which you keep the animals. And that, of course, has been a major argument from the industry. That it's true. I mean, that's going to cost initially a lot of money to go to different, to not have these kind of enormous production units with animals kept very confined, small spaces. But that's, I mean, we managed to do it in many other countries, so I don't think it's
the examples you gave are presumably the countries which were extremely bad places for producing antibiotic resistance in the first place. And so the impact of changes in Sweden and Denmark, negative.
In that respect, yes. But I think it was at that time it wasn't really a problem with regard to antibiotic resistance in mid-80s. That was not really a problem at that time, and I think it was mostly driven by consumers not wanting meat with residues of antibiotics in it. So it was kind of a different, and that might also be perhaps the best way to go about it, if the consumers simply don't want meat. Because there is always, I don't think that's the concern. I don't think that antibiotic residues in the meat is really the problem. But from a consumer point of view, it might be something that could drive this.
Are you as surprised by these percentages as I am? Because I would think that in certain farmers and slaughterers, their amount of interaction with turkeys is really orders of magnitude bigger than urban residents.
But you don't know what the baseline is, right?
Yeah.
That could be
I'm not sure
12.9% independent of turkeys.
Yeah.
Which means the turkey doesn't matter.
Well,
those animals also contribute to it.
Yeah, I don't think it would be, it's definitely not that high, but you probably have some percentage of kind of background of ERE in this population as well. But I don't know how high that is.
Peter, you should go to vegetarian.
I'm ready for hamburger.
Okay. Me too. I think I'll quit here. So it only took 2 hours and 40 minutes.
Slides did you do? 11?
Well, thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you.